Hey, and thanks for listening. This is Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Gibbard. Let's get started. This is episode 24 of Conversations, the True Voice Media podcast. I have a guest with me today by the name of Mark Schaefer, and he is one kick-ass dude who has agreed to be on the podcast. Mark, I'm glad to have you here. Can you tell the people listening a little bit about who you are, what you do, and, you know, kind of where you fit in this world?
Well, I'm just taken aback. This is the first time I've been introduced as a kick-ass dude.
Well, there's a first time for everything, and
so you know, I'll just kind of go with that. That's I'm probably best known for my blog. I blog at Grow and have a podcast called The Marketing Companion. I do with Tom Webster. I'm a marketing strategy consultant. I do webinars and do consulting with big companies. I've written a few books and I teach at Rutgers University. So I do a lot.
Yeah. So that leaves you plenty of time for leisurely activities as well, I'm sure.
Like doing podcasts with you.
Darn right. Darn right. Well, I'm so glad to have you on the podcast today. I really love what you and Tom Webster do on The Marketing Companion. I mean, it's got such personality to it, the banter that you guys have, and sometimes how, you know, the first, 5 or 10 minutes of your show, you guys are just going off and riffing on some really fun stuff. I think it's an example of one of those podcasts that's out in the world that takes itself seriously, but not too seriously, and really has found its own voice. So I really appreciate what you're doing there.
Thanks. Very kind of you to say. We have a lot of fun. Tom has a stated objective of cracking me up on every podcast. So
yeah, I can see how it would work.
If he can do that, he probably cracks other people up too.
I would not be surprised. I mean, that voice of his and like the things that he jumps into and drops into with, I mean, it's just hilarious. The last one I was listening to with you guys, you were in like a full on nearly crying from laughter. You were talking about apps.
Oh, that was almost embarrassing. Both of us were laughing so hard we couldn't speak.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And really, that is the magic of podcasting is – it's that real life, real world sort of thing. So you and I have been glancing collisions for, God, at this point, like 7 or 8 years, it feels like. We've been just kind of bouncing off of one another on Twitter. We kind of pass one another online in different conversations. In blog comments, we'll see one another every once in a while. Google Plus, we'll kind of see one another. But it's really nice to finally get the chance to sit down and talk with you. There's a couple of things you've been talking about recently that I'm so interested to talk with you about. And as I said, I'd been doing a little bit of my homework on you, just kind of brushing up prior to this. And there are so many things you've been talking about recently. I feel like we could have 10 podcast episodes, but I wanted to just kind of narrow down on a few things. But before we start, I have a bone to pick with you. It appears as though you have, I don't know, I'm going to call it substandard taste in coffee. Apparently you're a Dunkin' guy. I mean, I'm an avid Starbucks guy. I feel like is this going to be a riff that we can get past?
I don't know. Maybe we should just end it right now.
I don't know. Why don't we – how about this? I'm going to make a promise to myself that after this, if I'm too wound up, I'm going to go get myself a double venti grande soy chai latte, and you can go and get a medium.
You are out of my league, dude. Yeah. You are out of my league.
You're like, let me get light and sweet coffee.
You're like speaking another language.
Yeah, it's true. But all right, so here's where I want to start because I have a kind of list of things I want to talk about. We'll see what we can get through in this time. But you've been talking a lot about this this concept that you're calling content shock, which one, I'm going to let you kind of introduce as a topic because I think you'll do a better job since you've written about it than I would trying to interpret what you're saying about it. But I want to talk about this idea of content shock that you've brought up, but I want to look at it in terms of it's not just content shock, but I think it's an app shock and an everything shock that everything is becoming a crowded space. So let's talk about that. Introduce the concept for us and let's you and I just talk a little bit about that.
Well, the basic idea that I introduced in a blog post actually was in January and has continued to really build momentum throughout the marketing conversations on the internet. The idea is that we're reaching a place of incredible information density. And each time we go through a phase of revolution and evolution on the web. At the end of each phase, it becomes more difficult to be a marketer. So for example, when we first needed to have websites, if you were the first one with a website, you're going to be in good shape. And then it gets harder. If you were the first one to figure out SEO, great. But then as your competitors figure out, it becomes more difficult, becomes more expensive. The same thing is happening now with social media and content marketing, as that begins to mature, as people start to figure it out, as they're pumping more and more content onto the web, it becomes more difficult. And I think one of the most visible ways that we're seeing this happen right before our eyes is Facebook organic reach. The latest statistics I saw, an evaluation of 8,000 business Facebook pages by Agora Pulse, shows that the average organic reach right now is about 6%, and that in the last 12 months, 71% of those businesses had a reduction in organic reach of at least 30%. That is cataclysmic. And the reason that Facebook gives is there's too much stuff. There's more and more and more content. Their average Facebook user has the opportunity to see 1,500 stories a day, and it's getting worse.
But do you think that's the only reason? Is it the clogged pipes that they're doing, or do you have the opinion that it's also a revenue push, that they're trying to get more ad revenue?
It's a revenue push, but it's because it's becoming so popular, and it's because there's so much stuff to see. And so they're in a very good position because, you know, they've only got so much bandwidth. As the bandwidth becomes more and more clogged, they, you know, have an opportunity to charge people. So the implication for marketers is that you've got to spend more money one of two ways. You've got to find ways to create content that somehow makes it through that pipeline, and there's a cost to that, or you pay Facebook to do it. Now, the other piece of this is that, you know, people's attention span is finite. And right now, on average, Americans spend about 10 hours a day consuming content. How much higher can that go? You know, I'm not sure. But with our attention spans being limited and the amount of content literally exploding, that creates a more difficult prospect for marketers. And by the way, this is good news for consumers because it's becoming more competitive. It's going to force people to create better content. So it's good news for consumers. It's difficult news for marketers.
Well, let me push back on that concept for a second. And I agree with you to one extent. I do think that it being more competitive really ups the ante, and you have to produce better content. But doesn't it also, when you create a pay-to-play environment because of that competitiveness, doesn't that work against the actual end customer, that the audience of this? Because then the brands that can pay, that have the bandwidth and the money to do it, can put content out there, whether it's good or bad, and pay for it to get in front of you and push aside good content that doesn't have a budget behind it.
Well, that's exactly one of the points I made in the original post, is that ultimately the businesses with the biggest wallets are going to win, and that's the way it's always been. If you think about how let's think about television. When television first started out as a channel, anybody could get on TV. You know, they were looking for content. It was content. TV was a very, very local medium when it started out. You had, you know, local cooking shows and variety shows. And it wasn't that expensive to get on some of these shows, you know, as either a content producer or a sponsor of a program. But then as it became more popular, as the pipeline started to fill up, you've only got so much bandwidth, you've only got so much attention span, and it started to become more and more and more expensive. And now who advertises on TV? It's the people, you know, with the biggest pockets generally. And the same thing is happening on social media. As it fills up, as it becomes more popular, and I mean, every statistic you look at, every research study is showing companies are spending more and more on developing content. And, you know, we have a finite attention span, we have a finite number of eyeballs out there, and we're all competing for the same thing.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I'm kind of – I feel like in many ways I run a social business agency, so we're fanatical about results, and obviously we want to do the best for our clients, and if they have a budget, we want to make that maximized and all of that good jazz. But from a certain point, as a customer, do you share the sentiment that I do, that I think that it's a little bit sad that we have this disruptive technology where anybody could have a voice, and we're slowly trickling back into that TV model where the people with the biggest wallets are the ones that get the attention, whether or not they're deserving of it? Because I feel like the social media, the introduction of these technologies, it flattened the field, and that was what was so disruptive and nice about it. And now as we're throttling that reach and as we're moving back towards this media network sort of thing, I feel like we're losing some of that specialness. Is that something that in your world, as you see this, is a problem, or do you, you know, or do you squarely wear the business hat and say, you know what, it'll work itself out, or something else will come in and displace that? You know, where do you stand on that?
Well, I mean, honestly, I don't dwell on it too much. I think from a personal perspective, yes, it is kind of sad. But from a business perspective, it is what it is. I mean, it's economics. So, you know, let's, you know, put on our big boy pants and deal with it. I mean, we can't run our businesses for what we wish for. We have to run our businesses with what is. We can't whine about it. We can't complain about it. You got to deal with it. And so that's, I mean, that's how you run business. You've got to adapt. You've got to adopt. And if something has been disintermediated, and now it's becoming mainstream, well, then you've got to disintermediate again. And so we've got to become more clever. We've got to become more creative. And I mean, that's hard work. But look, business has always been hard work. And we just have to adjust. We have to adapt and adopt.
All right. So tell me this then. If the way it works is that things are going to happen, and as a business, the opportunity is at the early point, does that mean that you're encouraging, would you encourage businesses to start thinking as early adopters rather than waiting until it becomes a buzzword? And this content shock that you're talking about, do you think that this happened once content marketing became the buzzword, or was it already becoming a problem before the buzzword?
Well, I mean, you and I are in the business, so I mean, we – you know, kick this word around content marketing, you know, a lot. But honestly, in the general world, in general business, it's still a pretty obscure term.
There's some studies that are showing that marketers are, you know, that in terms of their budgets for next year and at the beginning of this year,
So who did the study?
Probably somebody like us.
Content Marketing Institute. Okay. Yeah. Next subject.
Yeah.
But I mean, I teach, you know, for example, you know, I teach a graduate level course at Rutgers University, and I get mid-level marketing managers from highly diverse set of companies, Fortune 500 companies in the New York area, small businesses, even, you know, entrepreneurs and consultants. And I mean, you know, content marketing is not a mainstream term. And it's you know it's growing in relevance certainly, but it's not really a mainstream term.
So what you're saying is it's not a mainstream term yet. We're actually in the phase of content shock. So what happens when it becomes mainstream? Does that put us at a critical mass where we can't even recover from it?
I think it's becoming mainstream, but people just call it different things. I mean, I think that, you know, to me, there's a very thin line between this idea of social media marketing and content marketing. Mm-hmm. If you're doing social media marketing well, content has always been at the heart of that. Content is the fuel behind your social media program. Mm-hmm. And I think the distinction here is that people tried to take shortcuts. They really didn't understand what social media marketing is about. They didn't really want to invest in the content, and they were disappointed, and they didn't do it very well. In a way, content marketing is a do-over for social media marketing, because, you know, content marketing, well, you've got to have content. You've got to invest in content. There's no other way around it. But really, you know, content marketing is kind of social media marketing in disguise.
Interesting. I'll buy that to a certain extent, except, you know, I would offer that I think social media marketing encompasses content marketing, but also includes things like social listening and engagement, where I think and even promotion and advertising, which you could say overlaps with content, but I think that they're slightly different things. And I think effective social media marketing probably takes on a number of more facets than just the content. But I'll give you this. I do think that for what most people focus on for social media marketing is the content side of things. So I think that's a really interesting way of phrasing it, that it's a do-over for social media marketing.
Well, I mean, I think, look, you know, 90% of the businesses out there are still focusing on likes. They're focusing on, you know, posting pictures of funny dogs to get engagement or something.
I love funny dogs.
Yeah, I do too, but, you know, you can only take so much of that.
Speak for yourself, sir.
And I think, you know, content marketing, you mentioned listening and monitoring and advertising as being something unique to social media. Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, let's put it this way. You can't really learn how to optimize your content unless you're listening. You are not leveraging your investment in content unless you're finding ways to distribute it. Content is the power in marketing today is not content. It's content that moves. It has to ignite. People have to share it and engage with it. And the main distribution for that is social media. Mm-hmm. So, it kind of goes hand in hand.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I'm not suggesting that it's, you know, these things are limited to social media or that they're not related to content. I think that they're all related. But I think there are elements of social that are not necessarily content. And there are elements of social media that are related to content. And it's all one big pool. But I want to step kind of a sidestep to that, because you've been talking about some things also recently that I think are interesting. I want to talk to you a little bit about these things. You talked on one of your podcasts a little bit about Elo and about Path and the economics of social networks. And I want to go into that conversation for a little bit, because what it seems to me is that there are entirely too many applications and tools out there, and it's getting very difficult to distinguish what makes one different from another, or why you should use one over the other, or why you should abandon somewhere where you're paying attention to go to another. So in this conversation about content shock, if we were to pivot and talk about app shock, I mean, are we getting to the point where there's entirely too many social networks? I mean, you spoke about Elo, and to me, I found that the podcast you had with Tom was, you made a lot of salient points and very interesting commentary about its explosive growth and this and that. I think that network is doomed to fail for a number of reasons. One, the lack of a actual true mobile application, I think, in today's day and age is just silly. I think the design of it, it needs to be improved. They're not moving quickly enough with updates. And I think ultimately they have no key differentiator for why I should post something there instead of Tumblr or Facebook or Twitter. You know, what's your take on, you know, the introduction of new networks that really present nothing new?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question and an interesting idea. And, you know, I think one difference that people underestimate is this idea of competition and choice and why it's different on the internet. In the real world, we like to go down the store aisle and see a whole aisle of breakfast cereal. When we're shopping for a car, we like choosing between different car companies. But on the internet, we only have the bandwidth for one Twitter. There aren't two Twitters. Mm-hmm. There aren't two LinkedIns. They have already filled their niches. So it's done. And it's going to be really, really hard to unseat those guys, which is why when new networks start, they don't care about monetization. They have to focus on one thing: scaling massively and dominating a niche. And once you dominate the niche, game over. Now you can figure out how to monetize. Now, so I think it's an interesting idea then to think about what defines a niche. Now, there could be something quirky about Elo. I think Elo started out where their audience is like artists and musicians. And if they have a big enough audience, even if there's no apparent differentiation for you and me, if there's just something about Elo that these artists and musicians love, well, then, you know, maybe that's okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe as long as it's big enough, as long as they have critical mass to monetize, then it may not take on Facebook, but that might be perfectly okay. So, you know, it's really difficult to say, you know, what the capacity is. I mean, the ultimate capacity is whatever niche has critical mass to pay the light bill.
So it's not necessarily a matter of coming out and doing something different or new. It's a matter of whether or not you can do something, anything mm-hmm. enough to grab enough attention and users that you can maintain at least the
momentum,
the possibility that you could monetize that audience.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So, but at what point do we run out of the ability to do that? So for instance, in dating apps online, if you were to look at dating apps in the App Store, which I know, you know, you're probably not looking at that space, but I am, there are a number of apps that are doing a variety of different things that are almost the same thing. There are 100 Tinder clones. There are a multitude of Match, eHarmony, and OkCupids. Yeah. If you look in the application space, there are a number of things that are trying to be a private social network, or they're trying to be a network that has stickers and that allows you to monetize your stuff. You know, at what point do we run out of the things? At what point do we stop having the capacity to because I'm already tired of it. I mean, I get calls for new demos for social media management tools, and I'm like, you're not doing anything different. Why should I switch? At what point do we run out?
Yeah. Well, let me answer that. That's a very rich question. Let me answer it on a couple different levels. First of all, I don't think will ever run out. And the reason for that is because I think as technology evolves, there'll be new ways to adapt and adopt ideas. So, I mean, you know, what does a dating app for Google Glass look like?
Got it.
You know, so I mean, Google Glass, it's not mainstream right now, but as wearable technology and augmented reality become more prevalent, some of these ideas will then adapt to these new technologies and present whole new platforms.
Yep. So your dating app could actually figure out through the Internet of Things that you like to keep your house at a similar temperature to this person, and at the same time you keep your refrigerator stocked with a certain type of food that we maintain a similar paleo diet, and at the same time you have a similar work schedule because that's when your lights go on. So, I mean, yeah, I could see that we could get to that level.
Yeah, I mean, who really knows? But I think one of the things that I see, and here we kind of see, you know, basic economics at work, is that it's the entry barriers for these apps is relatively low. I mean, it's pretty darn easy to make these apps today. There's lots of building blocks that people can use, and they can put out an app in 24 hours.
Yep.
Now, but is it going to scale? Are they going to get critical mass? And the thing that's missing in almost all of these startups is a marketing plan. And this is something chronic. I see, for example, when I go to South by Southwest, lots of people have big ideas. They're in love with their technology. They're in love with their new app, but they have no clue how to find an audience. And if you don't have an audience, you don't have customers. If you don't have customers, you have no revenue and you're going to die. So hand in hand with your big idea, you've got to think about how am I going to introduce this to the world?
No, I absolutely agree with that. And I think this whole growth hacking movement of, you know, the whole Ryan Holiday growth hacking, you know, building a big momentum and acquiring users before monetization and all of that, I think that's obviously I think it's what's trying to be the solution to not having a marketing plan. It's thinking about marketing in a way where it's about acquisition of users.
I hate that growth hacking term. But you know what growth hacking is? Successful marketing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a number
but
of different.
If people will fall in love with growth hacking and adopt successful marketing, I guess I'm all right with it.
Fair enough. It's sort of like if they adopt the term content marketing, but at least they're putting out good content. It won't matter if it's a buzzword.
I don't care what they call it.
Okay, but what about this? Okay, think about this. I mean, you're a Twitter guy. I'm a Twitter guy. You wrote a book on Twitter, The Tao of Twitter, very well received. And, you know, you're a Twitter guy. You spend a lot of time on Twitter. And I know that you're a fan of Google Plus as well. You probably have a Facebook account, and there's probably a series of other apps that you have, right? And you check in on these apps on a regular basis. You're looking at content. So let's say you've got 5 apps in your queue right now, and they sustain you throughout the course of the day. How many more apps can you add in there before you have to start getting rid of others, which means that the apps that are coming in need to displace other apps. As you said with the content, if we're looking at 10 hours of content, how much more room is there to grow? There's a finite amount of attention. And how do you think any of these new social networks are going to be able to gather our attention unless they displace something else?
Well, the key is they have to solve a unique problem. You know, and honestly, you know, well, here's an example. So one of the apps I really love right now is called Zeit. Zeit is like the Pandora for content.
Yep.
The more you learn, the more it learns about you, the more you interact with it, the more precise it becomes with the content that it is delivering to you. So over time, it almost becomes addictive. That solves a problem for me, because in this world of content shock, here's a little app that's helping me figure out what's important. What am I going to love? So that solves a unique problem. So that is going to be adopted. If you're just trying to be a me too, or the point of differentiation isn't profound enough, then ultimately you're either going to fail, or like I said, you're going to have to try to find at least an audience big enough to help you pay the light bills. But I think your point is right. It just kind of rolls into this whole content shock idea that we have a limited amount of time, and you have got to find an unsaturated niche. And as these apps, you know, roll and roll and roll, that's becoming more difficult.
No, you're absolutely right. So let's talk about how this – so we've talked about content shock. We've talked about app shock. And by the way, my dad absolutely loves Zeit. So when he listens to this, he's going to be like, Mark Schaefer likes Zeit also. Awesome. I'm an early adopter. He's going to love it. But I want to talk a little bit about the next thing, which I see as people shock. It's this idea that you know, so for – I just did a presentation on LinkedIn a couple nights ago. And in researching it, I found that, you know, the average resume gets 6 seconds. And for every job post, the average HR person is looking through 250 or more resumes. So we're looking at a very crowded space in just about everything, and people are creating content online. It's hard to sift through it. So I want to talk a little bit about the personal branding conversation that you had with Tom Webster, which shockingly from the outside I was listening to it, it didn't sound like he was disagreeing with you as much as it sounded contentious in the actual conversation. It seemed like you guys were very much on the same page, just saying it differently. But how do you suggest, whether it be apps, whether it be content, whether it be people, kind of what's the first step you think towards standing out in this crowded space? How do you think somebody should start off with it?
It really – my view of this is it gets down to courage, and that might sound like a very strange piece of advice, but here's my thinking on it. There are lots of different bloggers out there, hundreds, thousands of bloggers, and my blog posts really seem to resonate with people. And one of the comments I get is, you know, how do you keep doing this? How do you, you know, you create all this original content. How do you stand out like this? Every blog post I write, someone in the comment section will say, how did you know I was thinking about this? I was thinking about the same thing. We were just having a discussion about this the other night. Here's the difference. I've got the courage to actually step out and write about it. I don't think I'm necessarily smarter or more original than other people.
Oh, come on, Mark.
But I think that, you know, I have the courage to say, to step out and to add my ideas and to add my personality to the stream that's out there. I don't think I'm unique in my ability to do that.
So does that mean you're familiar with the Forrester Social Technographics profiles, the mm-hmm. seven different behaviors? So does that mean that you think that creators really have the most ability to stand out in this kind of new crowded online world?
Well, you know, what is the only source of differentiation you have is to be yourself. There, you have no competition. There's only one you. You have a unique education, a unique heritage, a unique background, you know, a unique perspective. So at the end of the day, that's the – and Tom hates that. Every time I say that, I think Tom Webster hates that phrase.
Which phrase? That, which phrase does he
end
hate?
End of the day. At the end.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that one's for you, Tom. But so look, anybody can write the 10 biggest mistakes on Twitter. It takes courage to write a post that only you can write, which is my biggest failure on Twitter, my biggest joy on Twitter, the biggest lesson I learned on Twitter, the thing that makes me angry about Twitter. And when people write guest posts for me, it's hard to write a guest post for me because I want people to write a post only they could write. And usually people, they step up to the challenge and they create something amazing, but it may take 3 or 4 drafts for them to get there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what you have to challenge yourself to do every single day. And if you can do that, even when you're looking for a job, how do you create content that only you can create? That is what's going to make you stand out. That's what's going to build your personal brand.
It's funny because it's not that dissimilar from have you read the book Lynchpin by Seth Godin?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. So it's this idea of being indispensable. And really the only way to be indispensable is to do something that only you can do so that you are indispensable, whether it be in the content that you create. I can't stop reading this blog because only Jeff can create this blog or only Mark can write a blog like this, or whether it's in the type of work you do or the app that you do, that it's so unique in what it does and you got there first and built that loyalty and trust. I think you're right. It is that courage to put it out there, but also the courage to put it out there as only you can.
It's really, really hard. It took me years to figure this out. And I know a lot of people are trying to do this and it might be discouraging and they see, so many people love Mark's blog. How can I ever do that? It took me years to figure it out. And I got a comment from a reader the other day. She said, every day I start my day with a cup of coffee and reading your blog. So, I'm not saying I've become indispensable, but I've become part of the fabric of that person's life.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a great achievement. That is something I get a lot of. I feel great about that. It's very rewarding to hear something like that because it shows that I'm doing a good job, that, how I push for better, more relevant, more interesting, more entertaining content. It's working when you get a comment like that.
I completely agree. I have I operate several blogs, but the one that I love writing on most is called A Day in the Life at jgibbard.com. And I just write my personal experiences of what it's like to build and grow this business, observations I've had, things I've learned. And it's all very much real, straight from my head. I think of a lot of my posts in the shower. But I have a couple of people that are very, very loyal readers. And it's what keeps me writing on that and keeps me loving to write that every day is knowing that I'm making an impact on at least one person. Because otherwise, really, what's the purpose of it? If you're just selling a few more widgets, that's one thing. But if you know that you're actually making an impact on someone, I can see – just for myself, I know that's a huge motivator.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because when you start to become part of the fabric of people's lives, those are the people that ultimately are loyal to you. And in this fast-changing world where not only are the platforms changing, the rules of engagement are changing, mm-hmm. It's really overwhelming how things just shift really almost on a day-to-day basis. Ultimately, loyalty is the killer app. Loyalty is what trumps everything. And so if you can create a brand, if you can create content that's actually building loyalty with people, that's very powerful.
Yeah. One of the things I often say to clients and just people I'm giving advice to and everything is if you want to stand out amidst the noise, the best thing you can do is focus on relationships and trying to have one-to-one relationships. And if you're going to scale anything, scale the number of one-to-one intimate relationships that you have, because that's going to come back to you in spades, because those people that are loyal to you based on those relationships are going to be the ones that are going to bring you new business. They're going to promote you. They're going to help expand your reach for you. And I think that that's, what I always always say is one of my competitive advantages is that I try to focus very heavily on each individual person that I interact with. So that's how – that would be my advice for how people stand out amidst the noise.
I think you're right. I agree with you 100%. And the challenge is scaling that.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I got a tweet the other day that I can't really argue with, but it kind of cut to my heart. And it was something like, you know, Gene Mark, what did he say? It's something like, your tweets don't have as much soul as they used to. Now, I don't know how you measure that.
Yeah.
But point well taken.
Yeah.
I mean,
maybe you're not putting enough of yourself into them lately. But
here's the thing. I mean, I really loved Twitter when I had a couple thousand followers.
Yep.
Right now, I've got 100,000 followers. And when I try to start a conversation on Twitter, it goes out of control.
Yep.
Because I'll post something on there, and now I'm challenged with having 50 simultaneous conversations.
Yep.
Okay. It's a different world.
Yep.
I can't scale that one-on-one soulfulness like I used to. So the point is well taken. And even though my heart, my head, my intent is really to love on people, I care about people very much. I care very much for the people who make an authentic attempt to build a relationship with me, not to game me or to increase their clout score, but who really want to make an effort to get to know me. I love that. It's the best part of my job. But it does get overwhelming sometimes just because the numbers are so big.
Yep. Yep. No, I can totally appreciate that. I mean, to a lesser scale, I deal with it, but I can imagine at that scale, it would be very difficult. I just think about, you know, in a similar sort of situation, just the number of emails that I get. I wish I could spend more time writing more well thought out, crafted personal responses. But when the volume is so high, it's just tough to get through them. So I can imagine when you're dealing with a multitude of channels where you're regarded as a thought leader by many people. And, you know, again, to a lesser extent, I have that. But when you get to a certain level, it's got to be very, very difficult to scale that. But at the same time, here's where I would make the point, though, is that you wouldn't have ever gotten to that point had you not engaged in that early relationship building and really focusing on making those people feel special in the early days. That's how you got to this level of scale.
Well, it's very true. It's very true. And here's the thing that everybody is in this business is either struggling with or will struggle with. You know, whenever you've got a couple hundred followers or a couple thousand followers, it's such a joy to be able to really get to know those people. When you get to 100,000, you know, in that kind of area, it's like being in front of a stadium and all you can do is like slap the hands of the people in the front row. That is not necessarily fun or rewarding, and you want to hug everybody in the stadium. That's just not possible.
Yep.
So the thing that you know, I think the accessibility and the humanness and the friendliness that kind of, you know, got me here, that is simply not scalable. And everybody struggles with that when you get to that point.
So do you find yourself looking to create smaller experiences? So you scale, you get to this point where it's unmanageable. Okay, let me go create something small again. And then that small thing builds and builds and builds, and then it grows out of control. So you start something smaller. But do you find, I mean, obviously you miss to a certain extent that really tightness, but is that something that you try to bring back in some way, whether it's through PATH or through a Facebook group or some way that you try to have at least a small group that you can touch on a more frequent and connected role?
Well, you know, some people have tried different strategies. I mean, there was a trend last year where a couple people with huge audiences like unfollowed everybody and started over. You know, I think that's disrespectful. I mean, I view myself as a teacher in everything that I do. In some way, I'm a teacher. And all these people are following me, and I really feel humbled by that. I feel honored by that. And they want to learn from me in some way. Who knows why they're following me, but they are. And I should be honored by that. I'm not going to unfollow those people and try to start something small again. You know, it is what it is. And somehow I've got to adapt. I've got to figure it out. I've got to find ways to be personal when I can, to be human when I can, to get help maybe doing that when I can. But, you know, the cow's out of the barn, as they say here in the United States, in America. You know, the cow's out of the barn.
Did they say that somewhere?
They do say that somewhere.
I'll buy that.
But the cow's out of the barn. So it is what it is. And I've got this big audience. The audience is going to grow. And you know what? That is a blessing to me. That is an honor to be in that position. And I'm going to try to help people and be respectful in every way I can, even though I can't do it like I used to.
Well, Mark, you're one cool ass dude, and I could talk to you for hours upon hours, but I know you're a busy dude, and you've got a lot of things going on, from the blog, the Marketing Companion podcast, consulting, books, teaching, and setting aside some of your free leisure time to come on a podcast and talk to someone like me and to my audience. And I really appreciate all of the work that you're doing and the insights that you brought to this particular episode. I'd love to have you back in the future. I really enjoy talking with you, and you got a great perspective. So keep on rocking, doing what you're doing. Can you let people know where they can go and be social with you, where they can find you? And I'll be sure to put them in the show notes as well.
Well, great. And first, thanks so much for having me on your podcast. This has been a lot of fun, and you know, kudos to you for asking some questions I haven't had before.
I try to make it different, you know.
That's awesome. I really appreciate the fact that you spent some time to do some homework, and thanks very much for being a supporter of my blog and podcast. So the best way to connect with me is through my website, businessesgrow.com. I had to call it that because nobody can spell Schaefer. And on Businesses Grow, you can find my blog, my podcast, my books, and lots of cool free resources to help you with your business.
Kick ass. I will be sure to put that in the show notes. And this is definitely an episode that I'm going to be passing around for people to listen to, because I really think we covered some really interesting ground here. You know, I mean, your coffee choice aside, I think you're a good man. You're a good man. Jeff doesn't run on Dunkin', but I'll allow you to.
Thanks.
Well, Mark, thanks for being on the show. And for everybody out there listening, thanks for listening. We really appreciate it. Take care. Thanks again for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed that episode of Conversations. Be sure to go over to iTunes or Stitcher and give us a rating. Tell us what you love about the show, what you hate about the show. And we hope you come back for our next episode. Take care.